You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
Hey, everybody. Today, I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. In the dynamic world of enterprise security, identity architects and IT leaders face a major challenge. Growth by repeated acquisitions multiplies the complexity of everything. Multiple IDPs, MFA providers, policy engines that all need to coexist. This can lead to fragmented user identities and policies that create security vulnerabilities and add access friction. Strata Identity solves this. Now you can decommission unneeded IDPs and consolidate the ones you'd like to keep without rewriting apps or disrupting users, engineers, and app owners. Plus, Strata's modular architecture makes it easy to integrate with any identity provider without manual maintenance and coding. Join the ranks of cybersecurity leaders using identity orchestration. Visit strata.io/cyberwire, share your top identity security priorities, and receive a pair of complimentary AirPods Pro. Offer valid for organizations with over 5,000 employees. Step into a new era of identity management at strata.io/cyberwire. Reports to the contrary, as far as anybody really knows, North Korea's Kim is still large and in charge. Poland reports Russian disinformation effort. The EU issues a controversial report on COVID-19 disinformation amid accusations that Europe is knuckling under to Chinese pressure. A cyber attack on wastewater treatment systems in Israel is reported. Caleb Barlow covers responsibilities during an incident from the SOC operator to the CEO. Our guest is Dave Weinstein from Clarity. He discusses threats and existing security violations facing the U.S. critical infrastructure. And the old Hupagon rat is back and looking for love. From the CyberWire studios at DataTribe, I'm Dave Bittner with your CyberWire summary for Monday, April 27th, 2020. We begin by addressing a story that's still developing and that remains inconclusive, but which, if borne out, could have significant implications for conflict in cyberspace. Reports have been circulating since last week that North Korean leader Kim Jong-un is either dead or incapacitated, possibly as the result, some outlets say, of heart surgery gone wrong. The New York Times offers a representative sample of such stories, but Reuters reports that South Korean authorities remain skeptical that Mr. Kim is anything but in charge. Reporting on the secretive North Korean regime is notoriously difficult, and most experienced observers think that the health of the Kim family is the most closely guarded of all secrets. Kim Jong-un hasn't been seen in public recently, but that's happened before, and the cautious South Korean official assessment is probably the safe bet, at least for now. According to the New York Times, Polish security services say that the country has been subjected to a complex disinformation operation whose structure and apparent goals are consistent with earlier Russian influence operations. The centerpiece of the campaign is a fake letter posted to the website of the War Studies Institute, a defense academy for senior Polish military leaders. Purporting to be from the institute's director, the letter calls for Polish soldiers to fight American occupation. The website itself was hacked, compromised, in order to post the letter, which of course is a complete fabrication. The attribution to Russia is circumstantial but convincing nonetheless. The disinformation is entirely consistent with earlier Russian influence campaigns, in both content and the ways in which its messaging has been amplified in small journalistic outlets and social media. U.S. forces have moved progressively eastward with NATO expansion in that direction. Their presence doesn't begin to approach the size of the U.S. Army Europe during the height of the Cold War, but U.S. forces remain, from Moscow's point of view, as unwelcome as ever. The content of Russian messaging in such influence operations has generally been consistent. U.S. troops behave badly, and they're not needed, and their presence is a standing affront to national sovereignty. Russian disinformation also prominently featured in a report the EU issued at the end of last week concerning disinformation campaigns that seek to take advantage of the COVID-19 pandemic. It's familiar stuff. Moscow is interested in using the emergency to increase mistrust among and within its adversaries. More interesting, however, and controversial, is the report's treatment of Chinese disinformation surrounding the pandemic. The European External Action Service's internal memorandum on disinformation efforts reached substantially the same conclusions as the U.S. State Department. Russia, China, and Iran have engaged in highly harmful disinformation that's gone viral, especially in smaller media markets. The assessment we mention is the EEAS internal report. According to the New York Times, EU officials, under pressure from Beijing and desiring to achieve more amicable relations, delayed publication of the report from Tuesday until Friday and softened the harsher conclusions about China before rendering their public statement. In the Times' judgment, the original report was not particularly strident, a routine roundup of publicly available information and news reports. The Times reports that Chinese government protests to EU officials were responsible for the delay in publication. For its part, EEAS has denied modifying its report under Chinese pressure. An EEAS spokesperson told Euractiv TV yesterday, quote, "We have never bowed to any alleged external political pressure," end quote. Differences between the two drafts are of the purely editorial sort that commonly arise when an internal document is revised for public distribution. The spokesperson said, quote, "As is the case for all publications, there are internal procedures in place to ensure the appropriate structure, quality, and length, and particular attention is paid to ensure that the phraseology is unassailable," end quote. Indeed, the public report does retain most of the internal memorandum's charges against Beijing. In the meantime, the BBC reports that China has also rejected an Australian-led call for an investigation into the origins of COVID-19, dismissing it as politically motivated efforts that would serve nobody any good. As the BBC paraphrased Chen Wen, a senior diplomat in China's mission to the UK, quote, "There were lots of rumors about the origins of the virus, but such misinformation was dangerous," she claimed, and said it was like a political virus and as dangerous as coronavirus itself, if not even more so, end quote. A British official speaking with the BBC on condition of anonymity said there was nervousness about confronting China since relations with Beijing are presently delicate. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson Zheng Shuang said at a regular press briefing this morning, quote, "China always opposes the fabrication and spread of disinformation by any person or institution," end quote, according to Beijing-headquartered CGTN. The foreign ministry's position is that there's no reason to think the virus originated in China, and that, insofar as disinformation is concerned, China is more sinned against than sinning. In fact, in Beijing's view, it's not sinning at all. They're the real victims here. For a summary of Chinese active disinformation about the coronavirus, see the EU's External Action Service's original internal report, widely available online and linked to on the CyberWire's coverage of the cybersecurity dimension of the COVID-19 pandemic. Pages 7 and 8 make a particularly snappy read. Dave Weinstein is Chief Security Officer at Clarity. He's a non-resident fellow at New America and National Security Institute and former CTO of the state of New Jersey. He offers his insights on threats and existing security violations facing the U.S. critical infrastructure.
Security with respect to critical infrastructure is still actually a fairly nascent field when you look at it on a macro level. That is to say that most critical infrastructure owners and operators are relatively immature with respect to protecting their operational technology networks. That's largely a factor of the burgeoning connectivity between their information technology networks and their OT networks. So 4 or 5 years ago, there was much less of a compelling reason to, for example, monitor your ICS network because it enjoyed a relatively high amount of security due to its isolation from the rest of the public-facing infrastructure. That has all changed in recent years, and organizations are compelled to take more proactive measures to lock down their systems. So it's still nascent, but the curve is increasing rather quickly as critical infrastructure asset owners and operators look to bring down the risk as fast as they can.
How are the organizations that provide these critical infrastructure components, how are they doing when it comes to applying standards and taking the steps to make sure that the systems are secure?
Actually, they're doing really well, and they're a very significant and often underappreciated piece of this puzzle. So I'm glad you asked the question. As you know, there's you know, a relatively small group of manufacturers that mass produce industrial control systems, and these industrial control systems are found in our factories, they're found in our power plants, they're found in our substations. And as I alluded to at the outset, there was never a real compelling reason to design these systems with security in mind. There was no encryption in place, there was no authentication, but that has changed, of course, over the last several years. And they are really taking the lead to build security into their products from the outset.
That's Dave Weinstein from Clarity. Israel's wastewater treatment infrastructure appears to have been subjected to a coordinated series of cyber attacks over the weekend. The Algeminer quotes official sources as saying the attacks were unsuccessful and that service has been uninterrupted. And finally, Proofpoint reports that the venerable Hoopagon remote access Trojan, venerable by internet standards since it's been around since 2006, has been repurposed to lure American university students with adult-themed dating fish bait designed to attract the lovelorn and insufficiently skeptical. While Hoopagon has been used by state-sponsored organizations, Proofpoint thinks that in this present round it's being distributed by criminal gangs with commonplace criminal goals. But should you receive an offer to get to know Ashley, a student who's looking for adventure, or to make the acquaintance of Laura, an artist who loves funny men, please do think twice. You will receive a nice helping of Hoopagon, whose features include, Proofpoint says, rootkit functionality, webcam monitoring, and the ability to log keystrokes and steal passwords. It may be old, almost as old as Ashley and Laura claim to be, but as commodity malware, it still poses a threat, even if it is looking for adventures with funny men. And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its zero-trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust Plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zerotrustAI. The IT world used to be simpler. You only had to secure and manage environments that you controlled. Then came new technologies and new ways to work. Now, employees, apps, and networks are everywhere. This means poor visibility, security gaps, and added risk. That's why Cloudflare created the first-ever connectivity cloud. Visit cloudflare.com to protect your business everywhere you do business.
The
And joining me once again is Caleb Barlow. He is the CEO at Synergistech. Caleb, it's always great to have you back. We wanted to talk today about some of the responsibilities that different folks have during an incident at all ranges of the organization. What do you have to share with us today?
Okay, so these are what I like to call the primary three duties that you have to think about when you're responding to a cybersecurity incident or you're building a runbook. And let me first say, Dave, this is not a legal construct. So all your folks over at the Caveat podcast actually could probably have some fun with this, but these are not legal constructs. They're more of ethical obligations of leadership during a crisis. And part of the reason why I wanted to talk about this is we're all thinking about crisis response as we kind of deal with coronavirus. And a lot of people are busy kind of updating their runbooks. So, you know, these are three things you can really look at in your runbook or your plan and say, have I covered this? So the first of them is what I call the duty to respond. And this is all about answering a couple of simple questions. Who detects and responds to an incident? And here's the tough one, Dave. How do you determine if an incident is of magnitude? Now, that sounds really simple, but let me tell you, it's really hard. Who decides? You know, who decides if a thing is a thing and kind of pushes that big red button to, you know, rally the troops and the team? Because remember, you don't necessarily have a lot of information when it first happens. And then lastly, in this kind of duty to respond, how do you communicate that an incident has occurred, realizing that the incident may affect your communications? Do you have emergency notification systems or ways out of band to get a hold of people?
What about the chain of command when it comes to these things of handling that internal communication? Is this a time when it's okay to skip around, jump levels, or do we have to? Is it important to maintain that? That line of communication?
Well, you know, it's critical to maintain the line of communication, but who's in charge gets really intriguing because I would argue when the incident, the first sign of the incident, the person in charge is that person in the SOC that's eyes on glass. But over the course of the incident, as the incident elevates, likely the person in charge starts to change. And this brings us to the second duty, what I call the duty to convene. So at this point, you've decided you have an incident of magnitude and it's time to convene your team. You've effectively pressed that big red button. Who's part of that group and who makes the decisions? Not trivial to figure out.
I imagine, too, this is a big practice like you play sort of thing where, you know, from your experience running these simulations, that's a very different thing than just having it laid out in a binder, you know, step by step on paper.
Oh, absolutely. And this, Dave, brings us to the next duty, which is the duty to act. You know, because at the end of the day, having a plan's great. If you're not willing to kind of pull the proverbial trigger, plan isn't any good. And you've got to make decisions quickly with limited data. So who's going to make those decisions? How do you handle lines of succession? How do you make decisions quickly with limited data and evaluate that risk? And then here's the big one most people aren't willing to do. How do you ask for help? How do you reach out to law enforcement or cyber counsel or, you know, competitors even? Some of the biggest incidents I've worked have completely changed because I was willing to reach out to my direct competitor and say, hey, are you seeing the same thing I'm seeing? Because if you aren't, then I've got something wrong on my end. And if you are, then we both need to act right now.
Yeah, and I imagine, you know, learning to put ego aside is critical, but so hard to do.
Well, and I'll give you a perfect example of this. So if you remember back to NotPetya, everybody was saying, oh, it must be phishing, right? No one was thinking it could actually be SMB. And, you know, I remember my team was working in this and like, Caleb, we cannot find the phishing email. I'm like, keep looking. They looked all night through literally 1 billion phishing emails. They couldn't find it anywhere. And I'm like, man, I can't go public with this. If this is phishing, I'm going to look like an idiot. So I ended up calling up Dave Maynor, who was at Cisco at the time, my direct competitor. And I'm like, Dave, I got to fess up to them. I can't find it. And he's like, thank God you called, Caleb. I can't find it either. And it was that moment where, because we're both willing to talk to each other as competitors, they realized, wait a second, this isn't phishing. This is something else. And it completely changed how everybody was looking at the response. And, you know, lo and behold, we found open SMB ports, right? And no one ever thought that was possible. But you've got to be willing to reach out to others and ask for help, even when it's uncomfortable.
Yeah. All right. Well, Caleb Barlow, thanks for joining us.
Managing the requirements for modern security programs is increasingly challenging and time-consuming. Enter Vanta. Vanta gives you one place to centralize and scale your security program. Quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for ISO 27001, SOC 2, and more. You can leverage Vanta's market-leading trust management platform to unify risk management and secure the trust of your customers. Plus, use Vanta AI to save time when completing security questionnaires. CyberWire daily listeners can get $1,000 off by going to vanta.com/cyber. That's vanta.com/cyber.
And that's the CyberWire. For links to all of today's stories, check out our daily briefing at thecyberwire.com. And for professionals and cybersecurity leaders who want to stay abreast of this rapidly evolving field, sign up for CyberWire Pro. It'll save you time and keep you informed. Listen for us on your Alexa smart speaker, too. The CyberWire podcast is proudly produced in Maryland out of the startup studios of Data Tribe, where they're co-building the next generation of cybersecurity teams and technologies. Our amazing CyberWire team is Elliot Peltzman, Peru Prakash, Stefan Vaziri, Kelsey Bond, Tim Nodar, Joe Kerrigan, Carol Terrio, Ben Yellen, Nick Vilecki, Gina Johnson, Bennett Moe, Chris Russell, John Petrick, Jennifer Iben, Rick Howard, Peter Kilpie, and I'm Dave Bittner. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow. And now a word from our sponsor, Netskope. Netskope is a worldwide leader in SASE and Zero Trust. Its unified platform, Netskope One, provides optimized access and Zero Trust security for people, devices, and data anywhere they go, helping customers reduce risk, accelerate performance, and get unrivaled visibility into any cloud, web, and private application activity. To learn more about how Netskope helps customers be ready for anything on their SASE journey, visit netskope.com.